content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the June 11th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the scene of the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, the throngs of people on the front portico with all the flags waving and just the general chaos. But in the foreground is Senator Mitch McConnell. He's holding a paint tray with a white paint in it and a roller. He's got white paint splashed all over his suit. He's kind of smiling back at the viewer, and there are already some white paint scenes over the insurrection, and the headline, not surprisingly, is Whitewash: Why McConnell and the GOP Blocked a Bipartisan Commission on the January 6th Insurrection. And I believe we picked that up on the Controversy of the Week, but we will start with one of the main stories: Biden's $6 trillion budget proposal. What happened? President Biden unveiled a $6 trillion budget proposal last week that would make massive new investments in education, transportation, and clean energy, and pushed the U.S. to its highest level of planned spending since World War II. The proposed 2022 budget puts together several of the policy initiatives that Biden outlined during his first 4 months of office. It includes his $1.7 trillion infrastructure plan, which would modernize and roads and bridges and invest in broadband and elder care, and the $1.8 trillion American Families Plan, which would subsidize child care and guarantee 2 free years of community college. About half of the proposed spending would be covered by higher taxes on corporations and top earners. The corporate tax rate would go from 21% to 28%, and the top individual tax bracket from 37% to 39.6%. This is a budget that reflects the fact that trickle-down economics has never worked, said Biden, and that the best way to grow our economy is from the bottom up and the middle out. The White House predicts a $1.8 trillion deficit next year and about $1.3 trillion each year after that for the next decade. Republicans quickly attacked Biden's proposal as too expensive. This plan promises higher taxes, higher prices, crushing debt, and less security, said House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. It is the most reckless and irresponsible budget proposal in my lifetime. Budget proposals are traditionally more of a presidential statement of priorities than a concrete set of expectations, and Biden's plan faces tough odds in the narrowly divided Congress. What the editorial said: this spending proposal is unprecedented in American peacetime history, said the Wall Street Journal. Even as the economy rebounds, Biden wants to keep using the cover of COVID to sneak through an expansion of the regulatory state at the expense of core federal responsibilities. His plan would give the Environmental Protection Agency a 21.3% funding boost and Health and Human Services a 23.1% lift. The Defense Department would receive a measly 1.6% increase, a budget cut if you factor in inflation. At least Democrats and Republicans are getting closer on the need for more infrastructure spending, said the Washington Post. Biden initially wanted a $2.3 trillion package and Republicans $568 billion. Now, after weeks of talks, they're at $1.7 trillion and $928 billion, respectively. There is less common ground on what an infrastructure bill should contain. Republicans want money only for hard infrastructure projects such as roads and virtually none on how to pay for it. Still, the president might just have the clout to get everyone to say yes. What the columnist said, the most important thing about this budget isn't so much the dollars it would deliver as the dogma it dismisses, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. For four decades, our leaders have been enthralled to an ideology fundamentally opposed to spending money to help ordinary citizens. That doesn't mean Biden's proposal is socialism. If implemented, the U.S. would still have a smaller government than most other wealthy countries. But his willingness to borrow and tax more to improve lives by making child care more affordable and energy cleaner could have huge consequences. They won't be pretty, said Stephen Moore in TheHill.com. In a temporary display of honesty, the budget forecasts yearly economic growth over the next decade to be under 2%. The causes of that stagnation are obvious. Biden's tax hikes will swallow profits that should be reinvested in the economy. And an ever-rising national debt, under the president's plan, it will hit 117% of the country's economic output by 2032, will mean higher inflation and higher interest rates. There is one objective reality deadline for all of Biden's ambitious plans, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. On July 31st, a temporary two-year suspension of the debt ceiling will expire. A vote on a debt limit increase will give Republicans the perfect chance to rediscover their fiscal hawkishness now that their free-spending 45th president is no longer in office. That coming fight will absorb time and energy that Democrats would rather spend on policy initiatives while aiding GOP messaging against the radical socialist Democratic agenda. And our controversy of the week, Republicans, why they blocked the January 6th commission. American democracy isn't dead yet, said Susan Glasser in NewYorker.com, but it's getting there. In the aftermath of the January 6th U.S. Capitol riot, when supporters of President Trump stormed the Capitol at his urging to block the certification of Joe Biden's victory, many Republicans agreed on the need for an independent commission to investigate the attack. Last week, however, a Republican filibuster killed a bill creating such a commission. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's justification was that the proposed commission would be slanted against Republicans, though it would have featured five Republican and five Democratic appointees. But the real explanation, as Senator John Cornyn of Texas admitted, was that the GOP doesn't want to give Democrats a political platform from which to make the 2022 midterm elections a referendum on President Trump and his big lie that the election was stolen. We've had commissions to investigate crises large and small, said Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com, from Pearl Harbor to 9/11. For the GOP to block an investigation into the only assault in U.S. history on the peaceful transfer of power is a grim sign for American democracy, shining among other things, among many other blinking warning lights. What drama queens Democrats are, said Eddie Scarry in WashingtonExaminer.com. Yes, the January 6th riot was bad, but this wasn't 9/11, and a grand total of five people died, including unarmed Trump supporter Ashley Babbitt, shot dead by police. With criminal prosecutions of the rioters already underway, do we really need a commission to study a few hours of civil unrest by justifiably irritated Trump voters? Democrats are not interested, in fact, said Daniel Henninger in the Wall Street Journal. Their goal is to keep voters focused on Trump-related January 6th realities just before the 2022 midterms. Why should Republicans erect a scaffold for their own hanging? Hanging. What an interesting choice of metaphor, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The insurrectionists erected a literal scaffold on the Capitol grounds, then stormed the building chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." because the vice president refused to block certification of the election. Republicans know any thorough probe will incriminate them, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. It may substantiate reports that some members of Congress and the Trump administration coordinated with the rioters before and during the attack. Further, it would spotlight the role dozens of Republicans played in voting against certifying the election and fomenting extreme right-wing radicalization. The partisan aims of the Democrats are obvious, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. Nonetheless, the nation deserves to know if members of Congress were involved in planning the Capitol attack, as well as why it took the National Guard more than 3 hours to respond while members of Congress had to hide. By blocking an independent bipartisan commission, Senate Republicans have handed the issue back to Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who will now establish a Democrat-run select committee, thus ensuring the probe will be conducted in the most partisan way possible. It needn't be, said Ken Ballin in CNN.com. As staff counsel to the 1987 Select Committee that investigated the Iran-Contra scandal, I've seen firsthand how a thorough, fair, transparent probe can help counter any claims of partisanship. We need answers to all questions about how January 6 happened, especially with renewed talk among Trump allies of the need for a coup. Our democracy literally hangs in the balance. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for thin air after an unknown buyer paid $18,350 for Io Sono, which translates I am, an invisible sculpture by Italian artist Salvatore Garo. The artist, 67, described the sculpture as a density of thoughts, but said in quantum physics, even empty space is full of energy. It was a good week for dog love after 17-year-old Haley Morinico of California charged a huge brown bear that was menacing her four barking dogs and pushed it off her backyard wall. I didn't know I had it in me, to be honest, Morinico said. Who in their right mind pushes a bear? And it was a good week for karma. After a boatful of Memorial Day revelers on Washington State's Moses Lake shouted slurs and gave the finger to another boat that was flying gay pride flags. Minutes later, the harassers' boat exploded, and they swam to the other boat to be rescued while shouting, "Help us." But it was a bad week for self-deplatforming after Donald Trump shut down his rambling weblog of rants from the desk of Donald J. Trump because so few people were reading it. It was a bad week for anti-racism after the Spanish Postal Service issued a series of equality stamps in four different skin color shades, but had to withdraw them after customers noticed that they were priced in ascending order of lightness. The 1.60 euro white skin stamp was worth more than twice as much as the 0.70 euro black skin stamp. Finally, it was a bad week for recidivism after Canadian Member of Parliament William Amos, who accidentally exposed himself to colleagues during a Zoom meeting in April, this time was seen on camera urinating into a coffee cup. Amos said that he would seek assistance. The short and other news piece on this page, Biden ends remain in Mexico policy. The Biden administration this week formally ended former President Donald Trump's remain in Mexico policy, which required Central American asylum seekers to wait south of the U.S.-Mexico border. President Biden paused the program shortly after taking office as he dialed back restrictive immigration policies. Since then, the Biden administration has allowed about 11,000 of the 68,000 people sent to Mexico to enter the U.S. to pursue asylum claims. Apprehensions by the Border Patrol reached 178,622 in April, the highest level in at least 20 years. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the numbers demonstrated that the remain in Mexico policy did not substantially enhance border management. The title of our briefing this week is How the Pandemic Ends. New cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are plummeting. What will it take to declare victory over COVID-19? Is the end near? Virologists are cautiously optimistic that by late summer, COVID-19 cases and deaths in the U.S. will fall so dramatically that life will return to near normal. Today, 135 million Americans, more than half of all adults, have been fully vaccinated, and in 10 states, 70% have received at least one dose. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that 100 million Americans gained some immunity by surviving coronavirus infections, including asymptomatic ones. As a result, the pandemic is already exhibiting exponential decay. That's a rapid plunge in transmission that occurs when the virus can find few new vulnerable people. New cases are down more than 90% from the January peak of 250,000 per day and are still dropping. Pfizer's and Moderna's vaccines are showing an astounding real-world effectiveness against serious illness and death of 99%. And warm weather is allowing more Americans to spend time outdoors, where transmission is dramatically less likely. By August, average daily COVID deaths, now around 500, may drop below 100, roughly the same daily toll of the seasonal flu. Things will look very good this summer, said Christopher Murray, director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. A lot of people will think that it's all over, but what happens in the fall is the tricky part. Why is that? The U.S. has a growing regional vaccine disparity, so there's a high risk of COVID flare-ups when the weather turns colder. Fewer than 40% of Americans in many southern states have received at least one shot, compared with 65 to 70% of New Englanders. By autumn, kids will return to in-person schooling, many families will hold large indoor gatherings, and immunity developed from previous infections may not provide full protection against variants. There are reports from India and Brazil of people who already had COVID once getting sick again with variants, and the UK is having an uptick in cases caused by the Indian strain. Is herd immunity possible? It's not likely for the country as a whole. Because the British variant now circulating in the U.S. is estimated to be 60% more infectious, most virologists now believe about 80% of Americans will need immunity through prior infections or vaccination to achieve classic herd immunity, where transmission stops. Mark Lipsitch, an epidemiologist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, cautions that disease transmission is local and may continue in some areas with lower vaccination rates. If the coverage is 95% in the United States as a whole, but 70% in some small town, the virus doesn't care, he explained. It will make its way around the small town. Do the variants matter? The Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines appear to provide robust protection against the known variants, but studies nonetheless suggest they may be 10 to 20% less effective. As the virus continues to rip through much of the world, it can develop new mutations and variants that make vaccines less effective. Less than a quarter of the global population has been infected so far, and many poor countries aren't expected to have widespread access to vaccines until 2023. Could COVID be eradicated? Only one infectious disease, smallpox, has ever been eradicated, and that was after two centuries of inoculation and a concerted 14-year campaign of global vaccination in the 1960s and 70s. SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, has proved to mutate rapidly. So epidemiologists say it is hard to predict how long immunity from prior infections and vaccinations will last. Booster shots may be necessary. In a survey by the magazine Nature, nearly 90% of immunologists, infectious disease researchers, and virologists believe the disease will become epidemic and circulate in pockets of the global population for the foreseeable future. What does that mean? We're going to defang the virus rather than defeat it, said Lipstitch. That's what happened with the Spanish flu, which evolved from a deadly disease to a normal seasonal flu as human immune systems gained experience fighting it off. There's a good chance COVID-19 will become less lethal over time since natural selection favors strains of the virus that do not kill their hosts. If infected people are alive and walking around, they can infect more people. Virologists expect COVID-19 to reemerge among the unvaccinated, mostly in winter, but over time to become more like the common cold, causing runny noses, congestion, a rundown feeling. About 20% of colds are caused by four different kinds of coronaviruses that have long been in circulation among humans. SARS-CoV-2 will likely join a long list of viruses that we just have to live with. As the old saying goes, said Dr. Ashish K. Jha of Brown University, pandemics end with a whimper, not with a bang. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Why guns are flying off shelves. In Fort Worth, prospective customers are forming long lines out the door at gun shops, and the cash registers are ringing, said Kevin Williamson. Semi-automatic rifles and handguns are selling out, and ammunition is being sold with a two-box limit, if it's available at all. The pandemic, political violence, and conspiracy theories. One gun store employee told me to expect concentration camps for white people have created an unprecedented sales boom in firearms and ammo. About 20% of all buyers have never before owned a gun, and that's a lot of guns in a lot of inexperienced hands. Not incidentally, African Americans and Hispanics are buying guns too. The fiercely independent spirit bred of the American Revolution and the frontier is an important part of what has kept America free, but it's also connected to the worst aspects of our national character, including paranoia, political and religious extremism, and our horrifying addiction to violence. It feels as if we're wobbling on the brink of something awful, with deep distrust among factions, governmental incompetence, and widespread simmering rage. This is a dangerous juncture in our history. Americans don't have a well-regulated militia. We just don't have a real well-regulated anything. Sorry, UFOs are probably not aliens. If you're hoping to get proof that aliens are visiting our planet, said Marina Corin, you're likely to be disappointed. This month, the Pentagon Task Force is required by law to reveal what information it's gathered about numerous unidentified aerial phenomena detected by U.S. military aircraft. In one sense, the objects seen by pilots and captured on radar and film are real and merit further study. But there's no reason to think they're alien. Why not? The space between stars in our galaxy is unfathomably vast. And unless extraterrestrials can violate the laws of physics, it would take dozens of years or centuries to reach Earth. Why would they do that, only to zip around in the clouds playing peekaboo with military pilots? More boring explanations are far more likely. Visual phenomena, camera glitches, meteors, or surveillance drones from other nations. If we do find extraterrestrial life, it's far more likely to be in the form of microbes or primitive organisms below the icy surface of moons of Jupiter and Saturn, or in signals detected by astronomers scrutinizing other solar systems and planets. Is ET already here, playing hide-and-seek in the skies? Nah. We have a column here from Mexico titled, "The U.S. Won't Save Us from Autocracy." Why would The Economist devote an entire cover story to attacking the Mexican president? Asked Enrique Quintana. The respected British weekly just proclaimed Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known here as AMLO, a false messiah who is leading Mexico down an anti-democratic path. The story details his many power grabs, such as threatening electoral officials and interfering in the judiciary, and AMLO immediately denounced the magazine as mendacious, accusing it of trying to influence upcoming legislative elections. Yet the real reason for the story can be found in its final paragraph, where it warns the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden not to ignore the stealthy authoritarianism in its backyard. The Economist is clearly hoping that Vice President Kamala Harris will carry a stern message for AMLO when she visits Mexico next week. But Harris has other concerns. She has been tasked with ending the migrant crisis at the border, and that will require AMLO's help. If Central American migrants keep pouring into Texas and other border states, Republicans will have the perfect campaign issue with which to bludgeon Democrats in next year's midterms. The Biden administration will happily overlook our president's autocratic streak to protect his own political future. Our in-depth article, The Last Word, titled this week, "A Year Without Rent." Eviction moratoriums have saved renters from homelessness in the pandemic, said journalist Eli Saslow in the Washington Post. But now small landlords, too, are desperately holding on to their livelihoods. The landlord had highlighted the first of the month on his office calendar and marked it as payday. But now the first had come and gone, the one-week grace period was ending, and for the 13th consecutive month, Romeo Badu had collected less than half of his total rent. "Time to try begging for it," he said, and he grabbed his booklet of receipts and walked out to his car. He drove through the low-income neighborhoods of Schenectady, New York, stopping at a half-dozen small homes that accounted for most of his income and all of his family's savings. He cajoled $75 in cash from a laid-off hairdresser who owed him more than $7,000. "Thanks for at least trying to work with me," he wrote on the rental receipt. He collected $200 from a renter who was $1,600 behind. "I'll come back tomorrow," Badu said, and then he continued up the street to his oldest property, a three-story home that had helped lift him into the middle class and was now sending him closer to bankruptcy. Badu parked in front and flipped through his receipts. The tenant owed more than $12,000, and on the porch Badu saw a pile of warnings and eviction notices dating back almost a year. "No more grace periods," read one from last fall. "Pay now or leave." In the COVID economy of 2021, the federal government has created an ongoing grace period for renters until at least July, banning all evictions in an effort to hold back a historic housing crisis that is already underway. More than 8 million rental properties across the country are behind on payments by an average of $5,600, according to census data. Nearly half of those rental properties are owned not by banks or big corporations, but instead by what government classifies as small landlords. And a third of small landlords are at risk of bankruptcy or foreclosure as the pandemic continues into its second year. For Badu, the essence of his problems came down to one house, 1042 Cutler Street, a three-story square box built in 1901, with faded green siding and fresh graffiti spray painted on the windows. The house had been sold four times out of foreclosure, condemned by the city, and scheduled for demolition when Badu first saw it after immigrating to New York from Guyana in the early 2000s. He worked at a nearby pick-and-pack warehouse for $8 an hour and saved up a small down payment toward a $79,000 purchase price. He'd rewired the electricity, gutted the plumbing, installed granite countertops, and begun renting it out for up to $950 per month. Gradually, those profits had paid for more distressed properties, for his daughter's college degree, and for a small home of his own where her diploma now hung above the entryway. He'd spent two decades growing his business on the first of each month until the pandemic hit upstate New York. "Just a friendly reminder," he'd written to the tenant after the first missed payment in April 2020. "Good morning. Are you able to pay rent?" he'd written after the second month. "Please, I am willing to work with you," he wrote after the government announced its first national eviction moratorium in September. "Really? You're still not going to pay anything?" he wrote after he read about the billions of government dollars being spent in rental assistance, for which his tenant never applied. Now it had been a full year without payment, and Badu had maxed his credit cards, applied for a secondary loan on his 2015 Mercedes-Benz, defaulted on $13,000 in property taxes, and started taking medication for panic attacks and stomach ulcers. Final collection notice read one of the bills that had been delivered to his own front door, and he'd begun mowing people's lawns and selling eggplants out of his garden to neighbors for a couple dollars each. "This is robbery," Badu had written. "What you're doing now is stealing from me." He got out of the car and walked around the house, the outside of the house. He didn't dare to knock because the tenant had accused him of harassment, and police had warned him about tenants' rights and trespassing on his own property. The yard was littered with a few empty cigarette packs, wrappers, and beer cans. Badu kicked a beer can across the yard, but then walked over to pick it up. Even if he no longer had control over his properties, he was still legally responsible for their upkeep, and he'd been fined four times for his tenants' trash violations. He took a trash bag out of his car and started cleaning up the yard. Alfonso Hill watched from inside the house until the landlord walked back to his car. "Yeah, like you need my money," Hill said after he watched the landlord drive his Mercedes up the block. And then he came outside, lit a cigarette, and sat on the porch. He resented many things about life at 1042 Cutler, the two-foot hole in the bathroom ceiling, the lingering smell of the previous tenant's dogs, the toilet that flushed only after he poured in a bucket of water, the broken furnace that had left the house so cold that the city had condemned it as unlivable. But what bothered him most was always having to repeat the same humiliations to the landlord about why he hadn't paid, couldn't pay, didn't have any money to pay. "Look, I don't want to be living here either," Hill had told Badu at one point. But he also believed the pandemic had given him no choice. He'd been paying rent on time for several months before the pandemic, living at 1042 Cutler with his 13-year-old daughter and his girlfriend, and cooking at a brick house tavern for $700 a week, until New York Governor Andrew Cuomo banned indoor dining on March 16, 2020. Hill had lost his job the next day, and then a few months later, he'd lost his girlfriend after arguments about the bills they couldn't pay. Now he was 38, unemployed, broke, and living alone with his daughter and her two guinea pigs. She was attending sixth grade virtually in their living room, but Hill believed the best way to educate a child during a pandemic was to prepare her for reality by teaching her some hard truths. Life wasn't a Disney movie, he told her. They were down to less than a few hundred dollars in savings. The pandemic was far from over. They were more likely to get COVID-19 and more likely to die of it because they were poor and black. And now the harsh reality he told her about the landlord was this. "He's basically the exterminator and we're the rats. Do you understand that?" "Kind of," she said. "I guess so. What I'm saying is he wants to get rid of us. It doesn't matter what we're dealing with. We're not human to him. We're money. It's all a big game. So Hill had taught himself the rules, researching on the internet about tenant rights, rent strikes in New York, and the eviction moratorium. He listened during the presidential campaign, as Joe Biden said, there should be rent forgiveness, not paid later, forgiveness. And so when Hill finally received some small unemployment payments and a four-figure stimulus check from the government, he used the money to fix the engine in his broken-down minivan, buy a little extra food, purchase some basic furniture, pay down his credit card, and surprise his daughter with a decent laptop for her virtual classes. Because why would he spend what little money he had on rent that he didn't actually have to pay? A few days later, Badu got an invitation from another small landlord. Going broke? It's time for landlords to unite, the message read. And a few hours later, Badu was sitting in a small office with 15 other property owners. He knew everyone in the room, and their stories were similar to his. Most of them were immigrants who had arrived in Schenectady at its lowest point in the early 2000s, after it had lost half of its manufacturing jobs and a third of its population. The city at that time was blighted by thousands of vacant homes, and instead of spending $18,000 to demolish each one, the mayor had come up with a plan to go to New York City and recruit Guyanese immigrants who had built a reputation for fixing up derelict property. The mayor handed out his cell phone number and offered to sell houses for as little as $1, and more than 5,000 Guyanese began to move. They bought cheap homes, rehabbed them, rented them out, and then started paying property taxes that helped revive the city. Now those same landlords were operating at a loss, and the city was trying to survive its own pandemic budget crisis by increasing their trash fees and raising property taxes for the first time in 5 years. It's a disaster, but what can we do, Badu said. And the other landlords started talking about how they dealt with delinquent tenants. Some were trading cash for keys, offering to pay delinquent tenants more than $500 in cash and forgive all overdue rent if the tenant agreed to move out. Some were cutting off their own heat or vandalizing their houses, hoping to make them so uninhabitable the tenants would leave. Then one of the landlords started to tell the story of what he called an involuntary eviction that had happened a few weeks earlier in Albany, where a landlord had become incensed after trying and failing to evict his tenants for months. The landlord broke into his own apartment early on a Sunday morning, held the tenants at gunpoint, restrained them with zip ties, hauled them out of his apartment, and deposited them at a cemetery 30 miles from his property. When you kick a dog, eventually it's going to bite, one of the landlords said. That guy's a hero, said another. It's not a real solution, Badu said. The only immediate solution Badu could think of was also the most unlikely, to collect the rent. So one morning he drove back to 1042 Cutler to try again. He parked his car and watched the front door. He sent a text message to his wife. Nothing yet. He listened to music and played a game on his phone until he'd been sitting in the car for almost half an hour. Pathetic, he said. More time wasted, wasted, wasted. He couldn't go inside the house. He couldn't demand rent. He couldn't kick the tenant out. He couldn't do much of anything but sit and wait and hope. Until eventually, out the windshield, he noticed something happening a few blocks down the street. A woman was throwing clothing out of a house and onto the lawn. She carried a chair down the front stairs and put it on the sidewalk. It looked to Badu like an eviction, so he drove closer, parked, and walked up to the house. Are you the landlord? He asked the woman, and she nodded. Wow, congratulations, he said, gesturing at the trash piled up on the sidewalk. I've been trying to get one of my houses back for more than a year. How'd you do it? It's not what you think, the landlord said. I didn't evict. They just left. Yeah, come on, Badu said. She laughed and then began to tell him about the way she'd dealt with derelict tenants in the past year, how she'd applied pressure through evictions and paperwork, stopped making repairs, filed suit in small claims court, and threatened to garnish wages until a few tenants chose to vacate on their own. I like to be reasonable, but eventually it's either my house or theirs, she said. And this is what victory looked like. An empty house, a family that had disappeared overnight, 28 garbage bags piled high on the sidewalk, an overturned dresser with initials carved into its side, a child's mattress soaked through by rain, and thousands of grains of rice scattered across the street. I've been lucky, she said. I only rent to good people, and most have paid. It seems like every other landlord is going under, but I'm actually trying to invest. I'm looking to buy. Badu helped her pick up trash bags and then toss them into an industrial dumpster. I might have an opportunity for you, he said, already feeling defeated by what he was about to suggest. You know 1042 Cutler? It's a good house. I can give you a good price. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries this week. The Mary Tyler Moore actor who captained the Love Boat. Gavin McLeod, 1931 to 2021. When Gavin McLeod was invited to audition for the pilot of the Mary Tyler Moore Show in 1970, he was almost 40 and still looking for his breakout role after some 15 years of taking bit parts on stage, film, and TV. The audition was for the role of Lou Grant, the growly TV newsroom boss of Moore's Mary Richards. But McLeod asked instead if he could read for the wisecracking news writer Murray Slaughter, who always seemed to be in the grip of a midlife crisis. He got the job, becoming part of one of the most celebrated sitcoms in TV history. Murray represented all the brown baggers, said McLeod, not just in newsrooms, but in all sorts of professions. People felt they knew me. He was born in Mount Kisco, New York, to a hard-working mother and an alcoholic father who died of cancer when McLeod was 13, said the Hollywood Reporter. Having gone bald at 18, McLeod initially struggled to win parts as a young actor, but with a second-hand toupee, he couldn't afford a new one, and some luck, he found a niche playing drug pushers, thugs, and malevolent cops in TV series such as Peter Gunn and Hawaii Five-O. When Mary Tyler Moore ended after seven seasons, McLeod achieved even bigger fame as the cheerful Captain Steubing on The Love Boat, said the Associated Press. Critics mauled the ABC comedy about the adventures of a cruise ship's crew and passengers as formulaic fare. But audiences lapped it up, and The Love Boat remained on air from 1977 to 1986. I don't care if it reflects life or not, McLeod said. I love happy endings. Life's so heavy these days that people want to escape. And a second obituary, the illustrator who hatched a hungry caterpillar, Eric Carle, 1929 to 2021. Eric Carle's masterpiece, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, is deceptively simple. The beloved 16-page children's book tells the story of a seemingly insatiable bug that munches its way through one apple, two pears, three plums, four strawberries, five oranges, and a series of treats including an ice cream cone, a lollipop, and a cupcake. After suffering a bout of indigestion, the now not so tiny caterpillar retreats into a cocoon and emerges as a magnificent butterfly. With its radiant collage illustrations, which Carle created by layering hand-painted tissue paper, and playful nibble holes punched in its pages, the book has delighted generations of kids, and since its 1969 publication, has sold more than 55 million copies worldwide. I think it is a book of hope, said Carle, who wrote and illustrated some 70 children's books. You little insignificant caterpillar can grow up into a beautiful butterfly and fly into the world with your talent. Carle was born in Syracuse, New York, to German immigrant parents, said the Washington Post. His father, a frustrated artist, instilled in his son the love of nature that later infused his books. His mother struggled with homesickness, and so when Carl was 6 years old, the family moved to her native Stuttgart. The young Eric loathed his authoritarian school. The one joy was an enlightened teacher who secretly showed him work of Nazi-designated degenerate artists such as Vasily Kandinsky and Henri Matisse. With the outbreak of World War II, his father was drafted into the German army and soon became a prisoner of war in Russia, said the New York Times. The teenage Carl was conscripted to dig trenches alongside the River Rhine. When his father returned from a Soviet prison camp in 1947, he weighed only 85 pounds and was, Carl recalled, a broken man. After studying graphic art in Stuttgart, Carl moved to New York City in 1952 and worked in advertising. Serendipity played a role in kickstarting Carl's career in children's books, said Publishers Weekly. Author Bill Martin Jr. admired one of Carl's advertising illustrations depicting a big red lobster in a doctor's waiting room and hired him to illustrate 1967's Brown Bear, What Do You See? Carl experimented with many inventive design elements in his books, The Holes in Caterpillar, A Flickering Light in 1995's The Very Lonely Firefly, but his use of colorful collage remained a constant. Some children have said to me, "Oh, I can do that," Carl said of his illustrations. I consider that the highest compliment. Here's a health and science article that may be of particular interest to you. Restoring vision to the blind. Scientists have used gene therapy and a pair of high-tech goggles to partially restore the sight of a man blinded by an inherited eye disease. The research is still at an early stage. The 58-year-old man could see only the faint outline of objects. But the trial could lead to more effective treatments, reports the New York Times. When light enters the eye, it is normally captured by photoreceptor cells, which send an electrical signal to motion-detecting ganglion cells. They in turn transmit signals to the brain via the optic nerve. Retinitis pigmentosa, the disease suffered by the volunteer, causes photoreceptors to decay and can result in complete blindness. For the new treatment, scientists inserted genes from light-sensitive algae into ganglion cells in one of the man's eyes. He then put on a pair of goggles able to detect changes in light intensity and convert that information into pulses of red and amber light to activate the treated cells. In trials, the volunteer was able to reach out and touch a notebook on a table. When researchers presented him with two or three tumblers, he counted them correctly 12 out of 19 times. It's obviously not the end of the road, said lead author Jose Alain Sahel from the University of Pittsburgh, but it's a major milestone. And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. Here's an article titled, Tokyo Olympics, Why Japan is Going Ahead. Japan is still in the throes of a major COVID surge, said Clay Chandler in Fortune.com, but its leaders insist they will hold the Summer Olympic Games starting July 23rd. Pandemic and public opinion be damned. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga and the International Olympic Committee, IOC, contend that bringing 15,000 athletes, officials, and media from 200-plus countries to Tokyo will be safe. But Japan has just extended a state of emergency as COVID cases soar, with barely 2% of the population vaccinated. Japanese business leaders, newspapers, and athletes have expressed opposition to holding the games now, and 83% of Japanese polled want the event postponed another year or scrapped. But Suga faces an election this fall and wants the Olympics to lift his flagging poll numbers, while the IOC doesn't want to lose billions in broadcast rights. Let the games go on, said Henry Olsen in Washington Post. The world needs a ray of sunshine after the darkness of the past year, and the Summer Olympics are virtually the only event that truly unites the globe in friendship. With other countries' help, Japan can pull this off safely. Fans from outside Japan won't be allowed, and athletes will be tested daily and confined to their residences and competition venues. Canceling the Olympics would be a huge blow to Japan's economy, said Yoshiaki Nohara in Bloomberg.com. The cost of hosting has ballooned to an estimated $25 billion, and canceling would cost Japan a direct economic loss of about $13 billion. That would come at a terrible time for an economy already teetering on the brink of a double-dip recession. Money is the chief reason anyone is even considering going forward with a summer game, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post. The IOC is pressuring Japan not to cut its losses and cancel, despite how outrageously irresponsible it is to divert 10,000 medical workers from hospitals to staff the events. Already, 8 Olympic workers tested positive for COVID during the torch relay ceremony last month. Yes, Japan and the IOC will suffer big losses by postponing, but gathering thousands of people in a country in the midst of a COVID surge could turn out to be a super spreader event. What might a larger disaster cost? Tulsa Massacre, Facing an Ugly Stain. A century after the fact, America has finally begun to grapple with a long-buried act of stunning racial violence, said Deepti Hajila in the Associated Press. The Tulsa Race Massacre of May 31, 1921, started when a young black man in Tulsa, Oklahoma, inadvertently touched a white woman and was accused of sexual assault. A white mob formed, and that night it descended on Greenwood, a thriving black community home to 10,000 residents. In a sustained assault that included the use of machine guns and using crop planes to drop incendiary devices, the mob killed about 300 residents and torched shops, restaurants, churches, and more than 1,200 homes. The neighborhood was left a smoking ruin, but nobody was ever charged with a crime. The horrific incident went unremembered and untaught until recently, when authors, filmmakers, and others started bringing it into the light. Last month, 3 survivors testified in front of Congress. This week, President Biden went to Tulsa to commemorate the centennial. As a black child growing up in Oklahoma, I never heard a word about the massacre, said Hannibal Johnson in the New York Times. Like a wound left untreated, the damage it wrought has been left to fester through years of silence and neglect. Though Tulsa's racial program is distinguished by its scale, resentful white vigilantes mass murdered blacks numerous times, in Atlanta in 1906, East St. Louis and Chester, Pennsylvania in 1917, Chicago in 1919. Owning and addressing that shameful history is crucial if we are to advance toward racial reconciliation. A law signed last month in Oklahoma City, Governor Kevin Stitt stands to impede that reckoning, said Tonwell Hobbs in the Wall Street Journals. It forbids public school lessons that might make children feel guilt or discomfort due to their own race or sex. Critics say the law, and many similar bills passed or proposed in Republican-led states, is a clear effort to stifle lessons about systemic racism. My fellow conservatives need to understand that it's not hating America to acknowledge this is part of our story, said David French in thedispatch.com. If we celebrate our proudest moments, we must mourn our darkest moments, ones to truly understand our own nation and be inspired to live up to our ideals. Thank God that we do not live in the America of 1921, but we live with its legacy. And to repair our land, we need to take a hard look at how it's shaped us. A few short notes. 1 in 5 Americans who bought a gun during a huge surge in sales in 2020 was a first-time gun owner. 39% of American households now own guns, up from 32% in 2016, amid fears stoked by the pandemic and protests over policing. The continuing boom in sales is unlike anything we've ever seen, said University of California Davis gun researcher Garen Wintemute. People working from home are putting in 48 more minutes more a day on average, according to a Harvard Business School study. But extra time doesn't necessarily mean more productivity, according to a second study from researchers at the University of Chicago and University of Essex. They found remote workers increased their hours by 30%, but with no rise in productivity. The pandemic was a boon for purveyors of legal marijuana, whose sales soared to $17.5 billion last year, a 46% increase over 2019. So far, 16 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana, and 37 states have legalized medical marijuana. American and Southwest Airlines have postponed resuming alcohol sales to coach passengers due to a surge in unruly behavior, mostly caused by people refusing to wear face masks. A Southwest flight attendant recently had two teeth knocked out. "We have just never seen anything like this," said Sarah Nelson, head of the flight attendants union. And we'll finish up today with a quote from John Steinbeck, who says, "Ideas are like rabbits. You get a couple and learn how to handle them, and pretty soon you have a dozen." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.